Welcome to the Baggage Podcast. I am Ryan Connor, comedian and writer. As always, Eric Shaw, pediatrician, former EMT, and Ryan Frank, prosecutor. You want to take it from here, Ryan?
Sure, yeah. I'm really excited to introduce our guest today, a retired lieutenant colonel from the Marine Corps, infantry officer, was in the years from 1963 to 1983, had a lot of experiences, I'm sure, from the Marine Corps. We're going to be focusing on his time and his years surrounding the Vietnam War. He's a Vietnam War veteran. He is one of my favorite people because he's my dad, Don Frank. And Don's going to talk today about leading up to the Vietnam War, and depending on how far we go, maybe even in the Vietnam War and his time after such. So with that, Dad, I'll hand it over to you. Where do you want to start? How would you, if you were talking to somebody about your Marine Corps career around Vietnam, they ask you, how would you start that conversation?
I think I would probably start it by saying, like all other retired veterans of any service, if you served during Vietnam, it was a very defining part of your life. Fortunately for me, I think I survived without any PTSD issues that I'm aware of. And I was very fortunate not to be wounded. But Vietnam was a major part of my life. And today, what I would like to talk to everyone about that's interested in listening to this podcast are some of my experiences that I had during my 4 years that I was associated with Vietnam. And not directly in country, but during that four-year period of time, everything that I did basically related to Vietnam. And I refer to this time period in my life as my three wars. My first war was, I call it the counterinsurgency, started in about 1967. My second war was the real war, which was the search and destroy component of General Westmoreland's strategy when he was in charge of all U.S. forces in Vietnam. And my third war was when I returned to Vietnam. One of my my assignment was to be a recruiter for Marine Corps officers in the state of New York. And I had all of the colleges and universities in New York State, north of the city. So I was on campus during most of the 69, 70, 71 time period. And the anti-war protest movement was the strongest on college campuses. So I'm going to start back with how I got to my first war, which was the counterinsurgency part.
Hey, let me interrupt you real quick, because I did 8 years in the Marine Corps. You did 20. And despite that, we've never really actually talked much. Some anecdotes. We've never talked about your time in Vietnam. And one of the things that I was curious about, and I think a lot of our listeners too won't understand the time frames. People associate the Vietnam War with a draft. You got in 1963, and you're talking about 1967. When you went into the Marine Corps, the Vietnam War wasn't even on the horizon, right?
Correct. No, but the draft definitely was a major part of what a young man was going to do with his life when he turned 18. And when Vietnam hit, then it made the decision for a lot of people. They had no choice because they were drafted.
But you were not drafted. You decided to
no,
go in.
I was not. I joined the Marine Corps. In fact, one of the jobs that I had, as I just mentioned, recruiting for the Marine Corps, is how I got in the Marine Corps. I was recruited by a Marine Corps captain when I was going to Utica College, a part of Syracuse University, in 1960, I think. And the Marine Corps, unlike the other branches of the service, does not have an academy. And we get most of our officers on what we call a PLC program. We do not have anything to do with the Marine Corps when we're going to college. We come to Quantico for 6 weeks in the summer, or we can do it once for 10 weeks between our junior and senior year. And that's what I did. And when I was recruiting for the Marine Corps, I was recruiting people like I had been recruited back in 1960. So I was not drafted, no. I had a college degree before I came into the Marine Corps.
Okay. Honestly, I don't think I actually understood kind of the background of how you got into the Marine Corps. So I didn't want to upset the flow, but you were talking about the three wars, sorry.
Okay. As I said, went in right out of college in 1963, came to Quantico and spent 6 months. And my first tour was overseas, and I came back to Lejeune, made a med cruise, and we got back from the med cruise in early fall of 1966. And something had happened in the Dominican Republic, and most of the Marine Corps was in the Dominican Republic. The rest of the Marine Corps were individuals were going to Vietnam. We were the only battalion at Camp Lejeune, and most of us, we were all, I wouldn't say most of us, those of us that were lieutenants, we were single, and we were very anxious to get to Vietnam. Our battalion commander made it very clear that he would not allow anybody to transfer out of the unit because there weren't any lieutenants coming into stateside commands. They were all going to Vietnam. So we found it really hard. We were stuck at Lejeune. And one of my friends came back one day and said he found a way that we could get to Vietnam, but we had to go to language school for 3 months. So we said, well, that's worth it. Let's go to Vietnamese language school. So we all went up to division. We took a test and we all passed the test. We got our set of orders, and unbeknownst to us, our 3 months had changed to 12 months. It was now a year of school. And it was a shocker, but we were on our way to language school. So we all came to D.C., and the school was run by the State Department. The classes were located in Arlington, and the State Department basically had hired or contracted probably 15 to 20 Vietnamese women straight out of Saigon who spoke no English at all. They lived in the building where the school was. There was a commissary in the basement, so they could buy their groceries there, and they never had to leave the building. We were assigned to classes based upon our aptitude. My aptitude for language was the lowest of the six of us who went to school. So I ended up in a class of 12 of us, mostly PFCs, one or two privates out of boot camp, and myself, a first lieutenant. After about 3 months in language school, I saw that, I realized that I was falling behind. Most of my classmates, because the instructors were living in the building and they were single, some of them started living with the instructors and they were experiencing immersion learning. If they wanted breakfast, they had to learn how to speak Vietnamese.
I think that's called a sleeping dictionary, I think is the term for that.
Okay.
Because the dictionary goes to sleep with you. Okay. Yes.
Correct. And it also woke up with you. I had just augmented in the Marine Corps, which meant I had changed my commission from a reserve commission. I only had a three-year obligation. I changed it to a lifetime contract. I could stay in the Marine Corps as long as I wanted to. And I knew from talking to a lot of people that flunking out of a formal school was not good for my career. I was heading towards that direction. So I went to my detailer or monitor, as we call them in the Marine Corps, explained my situation and said, get me out of this school before I flunk out. So he said, okay, I will send you to Vietnam if that's what you want to do. And I said, yes. So I got a set of orders to Vietnam. It took about 2 or 3 months for him to pull that off, but at least I got out without flunking. I ended up to Vietnam, arriving in Vietnam. And well, let me just backtrack a little bit, tell you a little quick story. Nothing to do with my three wars, but it was where I had my first command. And as a captain, getting your first command is pretty exciting. And I reported at Camp Pendleton on Palm Sunday back in 1966. And a woman Marine asked me if I was anxious to go to Vietnam. And I said, yes, but not really anxious. So she said, okay, be here tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. So I got there the next morning and I was assigned to be the CO of a staging unit. And the staging unit was 210 Marines were assigned to me. I had a company, and my mission was to make sure these people were in shape, get rid of or take care of all the medical problems they might have had. During that time, I think we had about 15 Marines who informed us that their girlfriends were pregnant, so we made sure that they got married before they went overseas, so their wife would have some type of insurance if something happened to them during the war. And my mission was to fill up a plane 30 days. I had to get 196 people through my staging unit so we could fill a plane. And I had 4 warrant officers were my platoon commanders. The total time in the Marine Corps for those 4 warrant officers was about 76 years, I think. I had a W-4, a W-3, and 2 W-2s. So I gave my commanders guidance as to how we were going to do things for the next month. We got all of our gear, and the CW04, who had 28 years in the Marine Corps, said, Captain, we'd like to take you to dinner. Are you interested? And I said, sure. So we went out to eat and had a couple of drinks afterwards, and we sat down there, and he looked at me, and he said, Captain, he said, you told us this morning that we were going to be doing PT every morning. Let me tell you, I'm not doing that shit. And I said, whoa, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, I'm a CW04. He said, I haven't run 3 miles in 10 years. I probably couldn't do it. I'd die of a heart attack. He said, we have all decided that because you're in shape, why don't you do the PT in the morning and we'll take care of all the other stuff. the administrative stuff. Now, all of a sudden, I have my first challenge as a commander. I have a subordinate who isn't doing what I want him to do. I slept on it that night and realized this isn't the battle I want to fight. So I said, okay. So I did the PT in the morning, and they took care of a lot of other stuff. I learned a lot from those four warrant officers, especially the one who challenged my guidance, as the really importance of listening to people. Just because you're in charge, that doesn't mean you always know the right thing to do. So I end up in Vietnam a month later, and I get to the headquarters of the units that were in Vietnam, and it was called 3MAF. It was located in Da Nang. At the time, the Marine Corps had two divisions and about a wing and a half of aviation assets in country. I don't know what our strength was. I would say probably the Marine Corps had close to 100,000 Marines in country at the time. That figure, though, don't check me on it because I'm not sure.
And I know you said it, but I missed it. What year is this?
1967.
Okay.
Now I think I said 66, but it's really 67.
Okay, you're in country in 67. Okay.
Early, I arrived in country in late spring of 67. Our Vietnam tours were 13 months.
So, I mean, in everything I've ever heard and the people I've talked to and kind of movies and literature, and I don't know, I don't have true numbers to back this up, but it seems like the Marines were overly represented in Vietnam as compared to the other, like compared to the Army. Is there a reason for that, that you guys were there and had such a larger presence?
This is going to be a very biased answer. I know we were the first ones in Vietnam, and I think that had a lot to do with the notoriety that the Marine Corps received out of Vietnam. The other reason I think the Marine Corps maybe got more press after the war or during the war was the area that we were assigned to was called I Corps. Commanders or Westmoreland, whoever decided how to break up the country, had broken it up into four or five corps, and it was the northernmost five provinces in Vietnam. Most of the combat that we saw was against the North Vietnamese regular army, which was called the NVA. And the army units that were fighting in Vietnam were mostly involved with the insurgency part of the war, which were the local Vietnamese that decided that the country was worth fighting for or not worth fighting for, and they had joined the resistance and were fighting for the North Vietnamese, and they were called the Viet Cong or the VC. So I think the Army did have more units in Vietnam than we did, but I think we got a lot more press than they did because of we had some really big battles like Khe Sanh, the Fiji Khe Sanh, and things like that. So I think we came out of Vietnam with more of a war history than some of the Army units did, I think.
I'm going to follow that up with a biased comment, too. I mean, that's kind of run, that theme runs through wars, too. World War II, certainly in the Pacific, for obvious reasons, but even like the Korean War, the Chosin Reservoir, like the really big battles, even in Iraq, the real big battles, the real trouble areas, historically, again, this is a biased answer, but have been assigned to the Marine Corps to kind of get the job done. So that's when, if you're going to write a book about big battles and stuff like that, you're going to just have a lot more resources from pulling from the Marine Corps.
Okay, I kind of forgot where I was. I think I just got in Vietnam and hadn't got a job yet. So I'm now assigned a job. I'm at the 3MAF headquarters, and I'm told that I'm going to go over and work with a unit which is called the Combined Action Organization of the Marine Corps. And what this was there was a lieutenant colonel by the name of Corson. It was his belief that the Marine Corps or all of the U.S. forces were not doing enough to win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people. So he convinced the Marine Corps that they should start working more with the Vietnamese locals to try to get their support locally, because we were losing the support both from the locals and fighting the NVA up north. So the Marine Corps, like the Army in all wars, had a policy that if you were wounded three times and still alive, you were sent home. So what the Marine Corps and the Army did, if you were wounded twice, you were pulled out of combat and sent to the rear to fill some administrative units. So the Marine Corps took a lot of the infantry that were wounded twice and sent them to Da Nang and put them in this combined action company. And I ran a language school teaching these Marines 30 days of Vietnamese, because once they graduated from the school or left the school,
Hold on. Can we pause?
Didn't you just fail out of a language school?
Right.
How did you get set up with that?
Okay. Yes. That is a true statement. I'd flunked out of language school, but
this is the military for you.
Yes. The school methodology for teaching Vietnamese was a vocabulary learn this and repeat it over and over, and after a while you'll learn how to speak the language. So I said, well, that's all I know how to do. So I got my boss to let me go back to Okinawa. We didn't have any textbooks or anything. I went to the Air Force printing plant and I took the book that we had used in school with absolutely no permission and got some copies made. I don't know who supplied that book. And if they listen to this podcast, they'll probably sue me for what do you call it?
I think the statute of limitations have passed on that. I think you're good now.
I made a few textbooks. And yes, Eric, I did flunk out of language school, but I became the dean of the language school in Vietnam.
Awesome. So all those Marines that are still in language school that are just acing it, they just know Vietnamese backwards and forwards, they're still stateside, and you're in Vietnam running language school. At this point, the only test you have passed is the one to get into the language school with no Vietnamese in it.
That is correct.
Okay.
I don't broadcast that to too many people, but now the whole world knows
it. They're going
to
know now, yeah.
So I'm running a language school. And one of the real challenges, and this is why I call it my three wars, most of the Marines that were in school had been in country for a minimum of maybe 4 or 5 months before you get wounded twice. And their only experience with Vietnamese were people that were trying to kill them. So when they were sent to school and were told they're now going to be living with, quote, the good Vietnamese, and we were going to teach them a little language so they could communicate with them on a very minimal basis, it was very hard for a lot of them to accept. They were going from one environment of hating everybody who didn't look like them to becoming friends with them and working with them and being comrades. So we spent a lot of time on the people-to-people and issues that really had nothing to do with the war, but had a lot to do with what we considered the counterinsurgency aspect of the war. And the school was going very well. We opened up the Vietnamese said, okay, if you seem to be having success teaching Marines how to speak Vietnamese, maybe we should start a school teaching Vietnamese that are going to be in these units how to speak English. So I started one of those schools in a Vietnamese army base in Da Nang. And I had 4 or 5 instructors that had been wounded, and they were staff sergeants. Again, they were just like me. Some of them probably hadn't even graduated from high school. But now all of a sudden, they're teaching Vietnamese how to speak a language.
Who would teach the instructors? How did they know?
They had no formal instruction at all on how to teach. They used the same textbook I did. And they went from the vocabulary or the whatever you had to memorize, you memorized in English and then translated it back into Vietnamese. So they were just Americans or Marines teaching their language that they'd learn how to speak with no formal instruction whatsoever as how to be a teacher.
So they were just winging it.
Now, let me go back. Eric, your question, how can I be teaching Vietnamese to Marines when I had flunked out of school? I think I didn't tell you, I didn't do any teaching. I had all Vietnamese, there were warrant officers who were my instructors. So basically, my job was to run the school, not to teach the school. So that might clear it up a little bit. Because I did not have the ability to teach anybody how to speak Vietnamese. In fact, I spent not a lot of time, but I would go out into the field to see some of our graduates, how they were doing. And I would always take one of the instructors with me. And I always found it very interesting.
You need an interpreter.
I always had an interpreter. And I would speak Vietnamese. I would try to speak Vietnamese to some of the locals. And I think they could understand what I was saying a little bit. But that when they would talk back, I would look at my instructor / interpreter, and he would tell me what they were saying. Vietnamese is a very difficult language. It's tonal. It goes up and down, and I didn't do the ups and downs very well. It's a very difficult language for me to learn.
Hey, Dad, we didn't tell you this. We should have mentioned this in the beginning. Ryan Connor was there last week.
I was in Da Nang 3 days ago.
Oh, three days ago. Excuse me. Yeah.
Well, Ryan and I were thinking about going back to visit Vietnam, and then the pandemic hit. And I think from what we learned getting ready for the trip, it has changed so much.
Yeah. I mean, Da Nang and then throughout the South. So I went with my brother, who's from Bac Liu, which I don't know if you had any experience that deep in the Mekong Delta.
But no, never got south of Da Nang, really.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's super far south. And it's definitely changed a lot. He came to the U.S. in February of 89, and his entire village was just, you know, thatch huts until around, let's see, he built his mom's brick house in 97, and that was one of the first in Bac Liu at the time. Now, it's still very poor to our standards, but, you know, no one has a thatch hut anymore. And, you know, ever since commerce opened with the West, you know, people aren't starving anymore. So there's a lot of positive changes there. And that far in the South, while there's growth, the natural beauty is still there.
It's a beautiful country. It really, I still have great memories of some of the beautiful scenes and
We had it booked. We had airplane tickets, we had non-refundable tickets, we had passport stuff, and we were supposed to leave in March of 2020. And I don't know if you guys remember what was happening in March of 2020, but not a great place in Asia to travel. So it was before COVID kicked off in the States. But we were having discussions like, do we push it? Do we not push it? Now, looking back, that was an insane conversation to even consider us doing it. And then it just shut down all air travel whatsoever. And we just never were able to reschedule it. So kind of sucked. But yeah, me and my dad were going to go and travel to all the spots that he was at in Vietnam.
Yeah. Can I tell you one more thing about the legacy there in the South?
Sure.
The mission of the South, I think is still like in their hearts. I was there for 15 days, never heard anyone call Saigon Ho Chi Minh City, for example.
Right.
It's still Saigon to everyone.
It's funny you say that, because I'm getting ready for this last night. I'm laying in bed and I said to myself, I wonder if anybody calls Saigon Saigon anymore. So that's great to hear.
Really, everyone calls it Saigon. I'm sure, you know, that, you know, the communists would not do that. And while there are, you know, there are state, you know, Vietnamese flags and communist flags throughout the Deep South, I think because the government knows that's where they're not liked, so they really push it in your face. But you don't see those flags at people's houses. You don't see them at people's businesses there. I probably saw just as many American flags as Vietnamese flags there.
It's interesting. You're almost in Vietnam at the same thing as the United States must have gone through after the Civil War. You know, very similar. You know, and maybe still going through it.
Yeah.
So I'm in the school now probably for about 4 or 5 months, and I would very much like to have a company during my tour in Vietnam. So I go to my boss, who was the G3 of 3MAF, and request to leave the school and go to a division and try to get a company. And he said, not now. The school's going good. There's a lot going on. Come back and see me in a couple months. Well, I go back in a couple of months, and now I've got 7 months in country, and I've only got 5 or 6 months to go, and probably nobody is going to want a captain. It's only going to be around for 4 or 5 months. So he said, well, go to a division. You're probably going to have to extend. So I extended for 6 months. Now, instead of a 13-month tour, I now have a 19-month tour.
Now, to clarify, when you say you were looking for a company, you were looking for a combat company. You were looking to see some action. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. as an infantry officer, it was extremely important for me for a lot of reasons that I had an opportunity to get a rifle company in Vietnam. So I extended, and about a week before the G3 rotated back to the States, he approved my AA form to go to the division. Oh, I have another story. I want to tell you this story, too, because my brother-in-law, back to what Ryan was saying earlier in the podcast about the draft. I have a brother-in-law who was drafted in the Army during Vietnam, and he and I were stationed in Vietnam at the same time. So he was an Army engineer in the South someplace, and I called him, and I said, hey, Bob, I'm going to try to get down to see you for Thanksgiving, and this is 1967. He said, okay. So I went to my boss and asked if I could take a couple of days off to go to south of Saigon. My boss reminded me that we were in a war, and Thanksgiving, as far as he was concerned, was just another day, and I wasn't going to go anywhere. So I called my brother-in-law and said, Bob, I can't get down there. And my brother-in-law, I think, was a spec through 2 or 3 or something like that. He said, well, I'll come up and see you then. So my brother-in-law jumped on a plane and flew up to see me. So it was Thanksgiving weekend, and we knew somebody who knew somebody, and we had lobster. We had a great Thanksgiving in our little school, and our school had probably about 20 to 25 Marines in any given class, and every 30 days we start a new class. We had a beautiful location. We were out on the China Sea. We could go swimming every day if we wanted to, and it was great facilities. So we had a Navy chief that was there, and he said, the night that we were having Thanksgiving dinner, he said to me, he said, what are you doing tonight, Captain? I said, nothing. He said, why don't you come over to the Chiefs Club? I hear we have a good band. And I said, I can't go. I got my brother-in-law here, and he's not allowed in a Chiefs Club because you have to be an E6 to get in. He's only an E3. He said, oh, make him a captain. Don't worry about it. So I
just
said, okay.
Real quick, for anybody that doesn't know, E3 would be enlisted, been promoted up to the third rank enlisted, and they're talking about senior enlisted and officers only club. Is that right?
Yes. And we were not allowed in there. We could go in as guests. If we were invited, but you had to be an E6 to be invited. You couldn't invite below an E3 into the club. So I promoted my brother-in-law to what I thought was an Army captain. And basically the Army and the Marine Corps rank is exactly the same in the way it's worn on a collar and everything. However, Navy wears the same insignia, but instead of having it parallel to the collar, they make it go perpendicular. And the rank of a person in the Navy who wears that insignia is called a lieutenant. And in the Marine Corps, that is a captain. So it's a little bit confusing if you're not familiar with ranks. So we go to the club, and we had to surrender our sidearms because we always carried a pistol with us every place we went. So we're drinking and going back and forth to the bar, and there happens to be a Navy chief who's had too much to drink, and every time he's going to the bar, he's pushing people out of the way, very rude. But people knew him. They would see him coming, they'd get out of the way, so there wouldn't be a confrontation. Well, he pushed my brother-in-law once, and I happened to see the confrontation. And my brother-in-law turned around. I think the chief said, excuse me, Lieutenant, which to him, the rank looked like a Navy lieutenant. Well, to my brother-in-law, a lieutenant is less rank than is a captain. So my brother-in-law thought he was an Army captain, which he was. So he told this chief, he said, don't you see this? And don't you recognize that I'm a captain and not a lieutenant? Well, I went immediately over and explained to the chief that my brother-in-law had too much to drink. We were going to leave. Because if anybody had wanted to talk to my brother-in-law and find out that he really wasn't an Army captain, he was an Army E3. We'd have all gone to jail that night. He for impersonating an officer, and me for promoting an officer.
You're in a foreign. You're in a foreign country, and you've taken enlisted, and you have impersonated an officer.
Yes,
not a good situation.
Well, we had a good time, and we got home, and everything was good. Okay, so I'm leaving my language school. I report in on the to the 3rd Division headquarters, which is in a location called Phu Bai, which was north of Da Nang. And there happened to be a lieutenant colonel at a desk, and it's probably 6:30, 7 o'clock at night. And I was kind of surprised to see him there. He looked at my orders, and his question was, does anybody know you're coming? And I said, I don't think so, sir. And he just stamped my orders 3-3, And he said, "Be at the helipad tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock." So I show up the next morning at 6 o'clock. And lo and behold, that same lieutenant colonel is at the helipad. I give him a salute. We both get on a helicopter and we take off to where 3-3 is located. It happened to be a location that we referred to at the time of Alpha 3, which was a combat location for an infantry battalion. They were permanently stationed out of that, working out of that area. And we were about 2 miles south of Cantien. So we were pretty much on the DMZ. We were the northernmost battalion at the time in Quantri province. So this lieutenant colonel goes in, and lo and behold, I learn very quickly that he is the new battalion commander. Well, the new battalion commander brought a captain with him that nobody knew about. And when you're in organizations and you see a new officer coming in, especially a captain, everybody wonders about, is that guy going to take my company, or what are they going to do with this guy? So I was not well thought of, or didn't get a great welcome for 2 or 3 days because everybody was worried that I was going to take their company. Well, I sat around for 3 or 4 days. Finally, I did get a company. Company commander had it for 5 or 6 months. It was his time to rotate. So I got Kilo Company. And this is now January of 1968. Tet was going full-time. At the time, we didn't know it was Tet. We just knew that there was a lot going on in the South. We all know now the problems in Way City and the battles that took place there. But what had happened during the 2 or 3 months prior to Tet, hundreds of thousands of North Vietnamese had snuck past a lot of our positions in the North, were strong enough to conduct a major offensive in some of the provinces in North Vietnam. And had made some very, very significant strides of controlling much of the real estate. We saw very little action during Tet because everything was south of us. I got my company in probably the end of January, I think it was. And I'd gone out on one patrol and nothing happened. We were going to starting to receive trucks from Phu Bai to resupply us. Our position was only probably 2 or 3 months old. It was basically carved out of the jungle, and we were being resupplied, or the battalion was being resupplied totally with helicopters. And it was a big strain on the aviation assets to supply that much food for that many people. So the engineers during this time were building a road, and my assignment or mission for February 7th was to take a company and to provide security for an engineer squad that was going to be sweeping the roads to ensure that the North Vietnamese had not mined the roads that night, because that afternoon there was going to be the first convoy coming in to resupply our position.
Dad, let me pause you for a second, because some people, I mean, really, if you're outside the infantry, military infantry, you probably don't understand sizes and positions in some of the titles. So you're a company commander, you're a captain, and you're in charge of a company. Mm-hmm. A company is subdivided into platoons. Can you tell us the number of kind of what size we're looking at when you're talking about a company?
A full company would have probably about 220, 230 people. That company would have three rifle platoons made up of all M16 rifles, some automatic and some regular. Then there would be a weapons platoon, and that weapons platoon, when I had it, was made up of 6 machine guns, M60 machine guns, and 6 rocket launchers. Normally, in a combat situation, the weapons platoon would be broken down into each, there were 3 squads, and you would assign a squad to each one of your rifle platoons. So that platoon commander had access to 2 machine guns and 2 rocket launchers. So you never employed a weapons platoon as a platoon. It always got deployed in 1/3 with the rifle platoons. So probably I'm not at full strength. I probably have about 200 in my company. But you also have, at that time, I had a whole squad of engineers, and I had forward artillery observers and FACS, which was a forward air controller for aviation. So I had probably 20 people assigned to my company that were not in my company permanently. So we probably left the gate that time with probably about 220, 230 people.
All right. So going back to February 7th, 1968. This road, you got 200 plus Marines, the whole company's going. on that mission.
Right. Right. Okay. It's a company mission. So I went down the road in what we called a V formation. I had a platoon on the right flank and a platoon on the left flank, probably a couple hundred yards ahead of the platoon on the road. They were sweeping both flanks of the road to ensure that there weren't any bad guys there. So when the engineers came down the road, they wouldn't be shot at. We had probably been on the road for half hour, 40 minutes. And my platoon, I was on with platoon on, I would say, on the left-hand side of the road. My platoon on the right-hand side of the road ran into a lot of combat. And the first word I'd got that the platoon commander had been killed. I sent the squad that was on the road to assist squad that had run into combat. They ran into heavy combat shortly after they left the road. I took the platoon that I was with. We crossed the road, trying to come around the flank of the other two platoons. We ran into heavy combat. We were pinned down before we realized we had run into anybody. And we were in some deep shit for probably 6 hours. We had run into what we realized later on was an MVA battalion that had moved into the positions that night, the night before. And we had run in, my one platoon had run into one flank, and I had run into the other flank. The platoon on the road had run into the center. So we basically were attacking an NVA battalion with a company, but we didn't know the battalion was there until we were in the middle of their position.
Now, to clarify, a battalion is somewhere between 700 and 800 men or more, right?
An NVA battalion had about 800 people, right? We think. So we had a bad day. We were only about a mile away from where our battalion headquarters were located. They sent out another company. They provided security around us because we were not in very good shape the end of that day. The next morning, probably had, we had lost 29 KIAs and 31.
How old were you when you were doing this?
I was 25.
Wow.
I want to interrupt you for a second, Dad, because I remember when I signed up for the Marine Corps when I was 18, we hadn't talked about Vietnam or anything like that. And I actually knew, but I'd gone to one of your reunions and I knew that a book had been written about your battalion. So I bought it. And that's where I learned a little bit about what you did in Vietnam. And I'm going to read a passage from your gunnery sergeant. So Gunny Clark. So you're a company commander, and every company commander, every captain has a gunny assigned to the company as well. And this is what he had to say about February 7th, going into the evening. He said, "Along about dusk, Captain Frank led an assault, one last assault to try to get through to the end of the second platoon. We received such heavy stuff there that there were two Chi-Com grenades that bounced off Captain Frank's flak jacket, just bounced off it. It was so hot in there that we couldn't get through, and we had a couple more KIAs in that little skirmish and some more wounded." Do you remember that?
Not really. No, I don't. There was so much crap going on that I really don't remember those things bouncing off. I do remember a couple of days later, this was my first combat experience. I said to Gunny, I said, you know, it's really funny the sound that a bullet makes as it goes through the grass. It kind of makes a snapping sound. And he said, "Captain, that's not the sound of a bullet going through grass. It's the sound of air coming back in after the bullet went by your ear," which is, I don't know how close you have to be to have air make a sound as it goes by your ear, but it's a lot closer than I had wanted to be to any live round around me. Mm. And you heard that a lot of me. Yeah. So
that goes through the evening. And then you were talking about the next morning.
Yeah, the next morning, I insisted to the battalion commander that we were going to be the company that went in and retrieved our dead and wounded. We still had wounded, and that was not a good night because there were a lot of bad sounds coming from that area. Some of them were our people, and some of them were the bad guys. We did hear probably an hour before the sun came up that we could tell the NVA were leaving the position. I think they knew that we had probably had some reinforcements. So it was probably about 8:30, 9 o'clock before we were organized enough to plow through the position or to go through that and to make sure there weren't any NVA left and to retrieve all of our dead and wounded. And that's what we did that morning. And it was a day that I have never talked about before in public because it's still a bad day in my mind.
I remember when I went to the reunion, I was 18, I had a goatee. I had signed up, but I did not look like a Marine. I went to your reunion. I had no idea, really no concept of what the Marine Corps was. And I certainly didn't have an appreciation for what other Marines had gone through. And I was constantly seeing people come up to you saying, seeing you for the first time. So this would have been 1998. Mm-hmm. So this is 30 years, you know, after the Tet Offensive had happened. And I remember old Marines coming up to you saying, hey, you were the company commander on February 7th. Man, what happened on your end? Like, they were getting information because it had been 30 years and they had never heard the outcome and didn't have all the information. And just it really struck me. I still remember it. Struck me, people coming up to you saying, still talking about that day.
Yeah, that day always been a day that you'll never forget. And I lost a lieutenant that day of the dead and wounded was a lieutenant whose wife was pregnant 6 months. And so he never saw his son or daughter and did not know what it was. But, you know, you recover from that. I had a great battalion commander. I did have some difficult times myself. My battalion commander had some very heart-to-heart talks with me. And I remember I was sitting at my CP a couple of days after that, and there were a lot of helicopters landing, and we were getting replacements for the ones that we'd lost on February 7th. And as soon as the helicopter lands, people scurry to get out of the way because we were very close to NVA artillery and rockets. And as soon as the helicopter would land, you would start to receive incoming, so you couldn't stay on a helipad very long. And the helicopters weren't going to stay there very long either. And we saw all these Marines running, so we had a total of, 50, 60 people to replace the ones that we'd lost on February 7th. And I saw all these young Marines running off the helipad, just going to, they didn't know where to go, so they were just clearing the helipad. And I said to this one staff sergeant, I said, you know where these, you know where those Marines were 2 or 3 months ago? And he said, no. I said, well, they were probably in high school. And he looked at me, and I'll never forget what he said. And he said, Captain, they're either going to learn fast or they're going to die young. And that was life in combat in Vietnam during that period of time, because there were some difficult times, you know. And I'm so very happy that I survived without even a scratch, you know.
Can I ask a question just to... from the leadership standpoint and kind of where your head was at as all this was going? Because I've been in scenarios, particularly around that age, where I was put in scenarios where I was in a leadership role where I was like, I have no business doing this. I feel like I'm not ready. And a lot of people are looking to me for answers, nothing like that, not hundreds of men, but sometimes dozens. And you just kind of go on autopilot where you're not even thinking about the decisions. You are just reacting and almost following like muscle memory or your training. And you look back on it and you either don't necessarily remember it all perfectly, or you just feel like, again, like you're on autopilot. Did you experience anything like that, or kind of just tell me about where your mind space during that?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I think what I got out of that experience was the critical importance of training. Prior to that time, I think I probably thought that, this is just another day. We got to go to the field. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. But you learned in combat that you fight the way you train. And that goes from the leaders right down to the privates and the PFCs. And I was on autopilot. I think during the February 7th itself, that to me wasn't nearly as difficult as it was afterwards, thinking what had happened. And rethinking of what could you have done different? Did you make a mistake? Did you do that? Second guessing yourself. And that's why my battalion commander was superb. And he said, you know, in combat, you can't second guess yourself. You got to leave that to the historians and all that sort of stuff and let them decide who was right, who was wrong. At the time, you do what you were trained to do, you know. So I can see, you know, being a young doctor, you got all these people around and you made life or death decisions, you know.
Let me just say this, that I think other people able in a position to kind of more objectively see your actions through that. And I'm not trying to embarrass you or anything, but I want to read something else that Gunny Clark said about that engagement. He says, I know one thing. Through the whole episode, our company commander, Captain Frank, is what you would call a company commander. That's emphasized. He was cool, calm, and collected through the whole thing. I've thought about it many times, and I know I was sure scared, and I think everyone was scared. And I'm sure he was too. But he sure kept his cool under fire, and he was really a company commander. He cared for his troop, his men, and did a hell of a fine job. And I know that all of the men that were there that day will never forget what Captain Frank did. Sorry. And how he did it. And how he operated and took care of his company. He is a mighty fine man. So that's how he thought you did.
Well, I have thought about that many times. And I do read Gunny Clark's thing. I keep that pretty close to where I can remind myself when I start second-guessing myself. And he was, as I thought as much of him as he did of me. We made a hell of a great team. He understood the Marine. He'd been in the Marine Corps twice as long as I had. And I spend a lot of time now, Sunday evenings, I go to Quantico and do a Catholic service for the Marine Corps officer candidates. And every once in a while, we never talk like I have talked right here, because that's nothing that they need to know about in the short period of time that I talk with them. But I do talk to them about the importance of the relationship between the NCOs, especially the senior NCOs and officers. It's a relationship, and when it becomes personal or a bond between them, you have to experience it in order to understand what it really is. And it's special. I think probably every occupation probably has something similar, but I think the military, and as I've said earlier, I'm a little biased. I think the Marine Corps is a little special. We really do put a lot of trust and confidence in our NCOs. They are the backbone of our organization in more ways than one.
I just wanted to ask a question. So you said the phrase, you fight the way you train. When I was in Vietnam, whether in Central Vietnam and Da Nang or on the Mekong Delta, the most striking thing was the terrain. I've never seen anything like it in my life. The density of the jungles, the omnipresence of marsh, it looked impossible. And we had a really somber moment. Like, we were just having just regular conversations, family, in a car. And I don't remember if it was me, my girlfriend, my brother, my sister-in-law who mentioned it. But I remember my brother, who's Vietnamese, lost one of his biological brothers, you know, who was fighting for the South. Another brother who survived. And he just said, he just like held his hand and pointed out at the jungle. And he's like, how do you do this? We didn't have a chance with the Viet Cong. You didn't know who they were.
Right.
And they just knew the terrain so well. So my question is, how do you prepare for something like that? And how do you go into that with the confidence that it seems you did? I mean, it seems impossible.
It's interesting you make that observation, having spent a lot of time in Vietnam and knowing people that were in a part of the war. At the time, I didn't realize, well, I probably did, but I never led point. You know, I wasn't the point of the company. And I always thought to myself, what was it like to be the Marine that was the first through the jungle when you've got 200 people behind you, when you don't know what's around the corner, what's around here, what's around there. And I didn't even know when I had the company that one of the platoons, I think it happened to be the third platoon, we had an Indian in the company who was a native Indian from some reservation out in the West someplace. And before he left, he told everybody his grandfather had sprinkled dirt all over him and did whatever the Indians do to keep you safe in harm's way. And he was fearless. He led every platoon, or every time it was his platoon's turn to take point, and we always rotated the platoons. And normally in the platoons, they would rotate because nobody wanted to walk point. It was a dangerous place to be. But we had an Indian who was phenomenal at sensing danger and not having any fear. I think it's individuals like that that make me successful to a certain extent. You know, it's not all the leader to a certain extent. It's the combined effort of the people and their skills. Because I joke to a lot of people that one of my strong suits, or I say that facetiously, one of my weakest skills as an infantry officer was land navigation. I had a really difficult time understanding the contour lines on a map. And I know that every contour line is 10 feet of elevation. And if you have lines really close together, terrain goes up and goes down. When it's as thick as the jungle is and everything, I really had a difficult time in my own mind saying, this is where I am on a map and this is where I really am. And I would be lost. I wouldn't be lost. I would be confused sometimes as to exactly where I am. And the artillery would have a round which was called a white phosphorus. And I'd call for a white phosphorus just so I could see where it hit. And sometimes I was not close to where I thought I was, because you get lost and you can't be lost. The terrain in Vietnam, especially where we were up north, was really, really difficult.
What I find fascinating, at least with this conversation, and when I'd listened to when Adrian was on NPR, some of the things you read for as far as like combat or about the individual soldiers and kind of like acute episodes of violence and things like that are problematic, where from your role as the leader, it's so much different, where you're thinking about the broader scope of it and how your decisions impact not only the combat, like your men and the other combatants, and just how differently that must land on you as compared to just the average soldier. And it's really neat to hear things from your perspective. I really appreciate you sharing all this with us, Don.
It isn't something that I was looking forward to doing, but I knew sooner or later I had to get it off my chest. So, you know, I don't like to talk about it a lot. Now I just talk about it so the whole world can hear it. You know, so it doesn't make any sense.
I like your optimism, the whole world.
That
we're going to have that kind of reach.
Heads of state are going to be listening to this podcast.
Sure.
Well, Ryan, I think we should probably take a break here. We have a lot of questions, and Don, we're gonna have to have you back on here
For sure. I got a lot of questions about the aftermath and just anecdotes about Vietnam. I'd like to hear about.
Well, thanks for listening. This has been really, I don't want to say fun, but interesting and touching episode of Baggage.
Do you want to plug your book again?
Yeah. Yeah. If you read books, I wrote one. It's called The Party. It's a political satire. And I also realized recently, I should tell people, it has nothing to do with Donald Trump. didn't occur to me that when people hear political satire, they assume it has something to do with that. It has nothing at all.
Do you have like MAGAs leaving you bad reviews?
No. also, I have a new special out called Live from DC. You can watch it on Apple TV or Amazon Prime. That's it for me. And check my website, RyanConnerComedy.com, for live dates.
I also want to plug a book. I was reading from a book that I first read when, again, as I mentioned, when I enlisted in the Marine Corps, but I hadn't left for boot camp yet. It's called No Shining Armor, The Marines at War in Vietnam. It's from my dad's battalion, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, written by Otto Lehrack. That's Lehrack. You can still get it. You can go on Amazon, still get it. And Lehrack was one of the other company commanders in my dad's battalion. So it's a really interesting book. It's written, it's an oral history. So it's written by the Marines that experienced it. So it'll jump chronologically from all the different battles and events, and you'll get little snippets from the actual Marines that experienced it. So it's a really, really good read, and I highly recommend it.
Eric, you do you have anything you'd like to plug?
I don't. I'm generally not going to have any big plugs. Different industry.
Any checkups or anything that you want to plug?
We're getting out of cold and flu season. We're moving into physical season as we go towards summer. So thank you.
Oh, nice. Are the baby's weights good right now these days?
Yeah, for the most part. Everything's doing really good.
All right, see you next time on Baggage.
Well, thank you for listening to the Baggage Podcast. If you liked our show, please check us out online at thebaggagepodcast.com. Please rate, follow us, and share on all the major podcast platforms. Also, if you have stories that you'd like to share from us or comments that you'd like to leave, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at thebaggagepodcast@gmail.com. That is the easiest way to get in touch with us, or leave a post on Facebook as well. Those are all good ways to get in touch with us. So we look forward to talking with you next time.